died before father was married. I think he died in 69. I think. You know, it was an awful age for little memorial sort of things. Brooches for the women or a cross that dangled round your neck, or a ring for the men. I have the ring that my great-grandfather had made. He had two made, one for himself and one for his son, when his wife died in 1813, I think it was. And also two little tiny brooches that people used so much lace in those days, and they had these tiny brooches that didn't weigh much for fastening lace. And he had two little brooches made for his two daughters.
Well, did these contain hair or something?
Yes, hair in the center, you see. Mm. But the rings have no hair in, they're just rather, well, I wear the one, they must have had awfully slender hands in those days. Mm. Of course, he, in his younger days, was a ship's surgeon, I think. He sailed the world.
What, your grandfather?
My great-grandfather.
Your great-grandfather.
No, my grandfather, I think the voyage to Greenland when he was stuck in the ice and rescued by the Eskimo.
Yeah, tell me about that again, if you will, because I was fascinated. When was this?
Well, you see...
Was he married then? Was he married then?
No.
He was a merchant in Liverpool, was he?
His father died when he was quite young, as far as I have heard. And his mother had, I don't know how many of them were, there weren't a great many of them that lived long. His elder brother was captain on a merchant ship and was drowned, went down, I think, with his ship. And he, I think, he was married. His brother was married, I know, because Grandpapa brought up the two children. He at least paid for their education. And he went to Liverpool from Scotland when he was about 15 and got into a shipping office there. And in the end, he had something to do with the people who afterwards became the Cunard Line.
Oh, yes.
And then he set up on his own, and he owned ships. And he really was, for those days, a very wealthy man when he was married, because he owned ships and he had this great big, well, he bought it when he was going to be married, I think, this big house in Liverpool, and it seemed to me that he didn't mind how much he spent in getting the place ready for Granny, and it was amazing the amount of things that he got. By degrees, men coming home from China and India, China largely, on his ships, and the captains were always instructed to bring something, if they saw something rather nice, to bring it for Granny. We had some wonderful scarves. There are still one or two upstairs that have never been out of their boxes. A Chinese one and something else.
Scarves?
Some years ago when we wanted... I don't know what happened about it, but Molly Tellison wanted to see these things, and she took two of them off with her to London because she said they shouldn't be left lying in boxes, and sold them to Liberty's. And Liberty's said that if they'd been a more fashionable colour, they would have given double for the double the amount for the shawl that was kind of puce and gold.
I know.
Oh, marvellous thing it was to look at.
I know.
But it wasn't a fashionable colour.
No.
And wouldn't please everybody. Mm. However, the money, Auntie was very grateful for the money because it paid for some repairs. Auntie was very foolish, of course, really, but she was very happy and it didn't matter. She took on this house, you see, and she'd no idea of the, when Granny died. You see, Grandpa had made his will when he was a rich man. And then when his nephew defrauded him of £60,000, he said he was too old to start making money again, and he retired over here and sold the ships to Mr. Kennedy, who had been working with him. It was in his office, I think, as a lad, and then, yes, because he had come from Scotland, and from the one part of Scotland, if anyone went to Liverpool, they were sent to Grandpapa's office, that he would find them a job, you see. Mm. He had an office on the Goree Piazzas, I think it is. And these two young men had arrived from Scotland, and he asked them to come to the midday meal on Sunday. And of course, he was a very strict Presbyterian.
Your grandfather?
And Granny had been brought up Church of England and much preferred it. But, that's a bad thing. Grandpapa and some of the other Scotsmen, the Richies and the Rankins, and what was the other man? Anyway, they all lived somewhere in what's now a Norfolk slum, I think, Upper Parliament Street in Liverpool. They had huge houses with stables and cow houses at the back. Yes. And they all had their own cows all winter. And when they came over here in the summer, the cows were sent out to grass at a farm in Cheshire, brought back in the winter, where the cook cow had to be able to milk, because they had their own milk, you see.
Yeah.
And the house was eventually bought and I think pulled down and a library built on the spot.
So when your father went to Greenland then, he was not married.
No.
But he had his own ship then,
I think he was, I can't remember whether it was John Rankin or James who wrote a history of their firm, and it ought to be here, but Will borrowed it, and Mother and Olive said, I didn't return it because I thought Duncan would like it. Well, that's all right, really. But in it, he gives this thing that they had, either it was something to do with Fur or Hudson Bay or something, but anyhow, this young man went out, and this was rather late in the autumn, and they got stuck in the ice on the shores of Greenland, I think it was. And they had large cargoes of apples on board, which they were taking as presents for the Eskimo and people. But they thought they were doomed, I think. And an Eskimo woman, I couldn't tell you how many miles away, but she was quite a bit away from them, had a, in the night, three nights in succession, she dreamed and thought she saw a boat held in the ice at this particular place. And after the third night, she was so sure of it that she persuaded her menfolk to take the dogs and the sleighs and go and see what was happening. And they found the ship and the men and Grandpa. I think he was the only one apart from the ship's crew. I don't think there were any other strangers on board. And they'd come to their last barrel of apples. And they've no other food but this to carry them on. So she was just in time. And they took them back to their igloos and fed them on what they had and were good to them and managed to get word to missionaries that they had this boatload of people. And the missionaries got word to England somehow or other, and a government frigate or cruiser or whatever it is, frigate I think Duncan said the thing was sent out to collect them and bring them back to Liverpool. And as long as any of that tribe survived, Grandpa, this is all hearsay, you see, Mike.
Yes.
He sent them at Christmas red flannel, because they had, that was a great treasure to them, and various things of food, all things that he knew would be useful. But when the last of that tribe died, well, he probably died too.
And this is the ship that you have in the hall here.
And this is a model of the ship that the government boat, the navy that rescued them.
A square-rigged sailing ship. A square-rigged sailing ship.
Yes. And we have the white ensign upstairs. It's rather tattered, but it's there, that was flown on that ship. Yeah. And when they got into Liverpool again, no doubt Grandpapa gave them presents, or the Rankins did, whoever he went for, but the captain presented him with the flag.
What year was this? What year was this? Roughly?
Well, now, wait a minute. He was married in 1830. It must have been about 1825.
And he was married in 1830. And he came to the Isle of Man first between the Greenland adventure and getting married, did he?
No, it was 2 years after he was married.
I see.
I don't know, we never heard the name of the man he came with. It was one of these men in Liverpool, I suppose, that had business over here. And Granny said that he came in one day. He used to go off to his office in the morning and return about 5:30 or 6:00. For dinner at night. She used to give him sandwiches, she said, to take with him, but he never, very rarely ate them. He had a really good breakfast, a Scotsman's breakfast, and didn't bother with more food until, he may have had a glass of whiskey, probably old Scotsman drank whiskey. But, he came in one day and he said to her that somebody or other was going to the Isle of Man. And she was quite interested and said, oh yes, I know it's a little island in the Irish Sea. And he said, would you mind if I went? Oh no, she said. How and when? Well, next week when the packet is going. And we'd be there a week, very likely. So that was that. He came with the friend, and whatever the business was in Douglas, I don't know, but the they didn't take them all their time, but of course they couldn't get away on for the week, you see, and so they took a gig to have a drive round the north of the island and see what it was like. I don't quite know what the date of the Point de Vere lighthouse is, whether it was being built then or whether it was built then, but their aim was to come down and go out to the Point of Ayr, for it was the nearest point to Scotland. So they came down, they passed this gate, and there was a notice, a pole out, and a notice, sail going on here. So they said, what fun it would be to go in and see, because they rather regarded the Manx people as kind of aborigines. And fun it would be to go in and see what was happening at the sale. So they went in.
What sort of house was this then? More or less a cottage?
Yes, it was the back. Our present kitchen was a passage off it, opposite the two doors, and it was a bedroom. And the pantry was, and then the schoolroom was another bedroom, and the linen room was the sitting room, and the room behind here, which is surrounded by buildings now, was the kitchen. And so that it was like, the schoolroom, I think, was two bedrooms, they said, two small bedrooms. I think there's a mark in the floor somewhere where there was, I don't know how they got in and out, but that was that. And then he got an architect to plan this front, which he built on. You see, that door at the foot of the stairs is the old entrance door. I mean, it's where the old entrance door was. And he built in front of the cottage and on top of it, for there was no upstairs, and it had belonged to an old sea captain who had planted a great number of poplar trees, which are all gone long before my day, and called it Poplar Grove. So when they came out to go away again, the friend said to Grandpapa, "What in the world did you do that for, Gib? What are you going to do with a shack over here?" And he said, "A very nice place to send my wife and children for the summer. Liverpool is not too good for them. And they can have 6 months here and come back to Liverpool for the winter." At that time he had 4 little girls, I think. Well, Tossie, that was that. And when he went back and told Granny about it, she was, I don't think she was very pleased. But she said to me, "I've been very happy in a large mansion and in this cottage, and that's what matters." Not sure what his surname was. I think I have heard it. It may come back to me.
And he had a flag out showing there was a sail, did he?
But then that must have been in about 36, I should think, because he got hold of an architect to build this bit on and said what he wanted and so on, and about getting these poulvesh marble and for the rooms, and funnily enough, a man was here some years ago now, who said his old uncle had cut the and polished the pillars and things for this.
Really? And what other buildings were there round here then? Was Thornhill built?
There was no. Thornhill was built in the best blackberry field. Always a kind of feeling among the aunts that Mr. Collister bought their best blackberry field. And when he built it, after it was built, there was only the back avenue. So he begged Grandpapa to sell him half the paddock so that he could make the front avenue.
And then your grandfather's land went right on down towards Ballacrink, did it?
Yes. It went as far as Richmond's on this side of the road, and then he owned all Ballacrink and as far as... almost as far as St. Olive's Church.
Mm-hmm.
The cottage hospital was where the coachman's cottage was.
And Grovemount was what, stables? Grovemount was stables or something, was it?
Well, it was really part of Ballacrink, but Mr. Cowley, Deemster Cowley's father, wanted to get a name for it as a building site, you see. And he said, do you mind if I call it Grovemount? And Granny said, no, I don't mind.
This was after your...
After the Grove, yes.
Yes, and after...
But the Grove,
your grandfather's
part
death.
Of it is Ballacrink, and part of it is... I don't know whether the house is on Ballacarbery or not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the bottom field by Richmond's is part of Ballacrink.
And you were saying that there were three houses only north of the stone bridge.
Yes, there was Ballacrink, the coachman's cottage, and what we used to call Mrs. Nina's, that house down where there were tennis courts, and it's all built, you know, now, down by the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Just where you turn up Windsor Road,
yes.
The house on that corner.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being in the lawyer's office one day when Cloutier was alive, and he was talking about things, and he said, and I said that Auntie said this about the three houses, and he said, oh, surely, Dr. Templeton's, that's the house on the other side. I've forgotten the name of the people who have it now. And the little white cottage just by Dr. Mary's, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Surely those were there. And I said, well, Auntie said they weren't, but you may be right. So he dug up a book that he had, which was a kind of, I think, kind of history of early Ramsay. And he said, no, you're right, they weren't built then.
There was probably Cronk Ash, was it?
Yes.
Cronk Ash.
Cronk Ash, yes.
Where Mr. Saltz lives now.
Yes.
Well then, when was your father born? Was he born in the Isle of Man or in Liverpool?
Oh, the children were all born in Liverpool.
All of them?
Yes.
Including
because
your family?
Granny had four daughters and then three sons, but only father lived to grow up.
Mm-hmm. And when was he born, Miss Gibb?
Hmm?
When was he born?
Auntie was born 34. 1838, I think.
1838.
Mm.
And why did he join the East India Company? Because his father traded with it?
No, because his mother's cousin, who afterwards became his brother-in-law, His mother's cousin was a partner in the East India Company, a man named Scott. And he said that there was a good opening out there and that Grandpapa had better let, when his son left Harrow, he'd better let him come out to him. So when Father was 18, he went out to India to Uncle William.
Straight from Harrow. Mm. So that would be 1856, roundabout. Yes. That's what, after the mutiny. Yes.
I think they...
Yes,
after yes, the mutiny. Yes, I suppose so. Yes. He would be after... Aunt Kate, I know, was there during the mutiny.
Mm. Where did he go to? Mm. Did he go to Madras or where?
They were... where were they? Must have been that they were somewhere near Madras. I was going to say Calcutta, but I'm not sure. I think it wasn't. I don't think it was. But I know Aunt Kate told us afterwards that during the mutiny that Uncle William went to the office every day, and as it happened, all their servants and people were loyal. But he left her with a loaded revolver. And she said, I was almost afraid to leave the nursery where the children were. Mm. And I sat there with this loaded revolver by my side and had food brought to me till he came back in the evening.
Amazing. Then your father got sick.
Mm. Yes.
What was it?
So did Uncle William in the end, and he died on the voyage home. Father survived to get home. And
and how many years after going out was this? What sort of age was he?
Hmm?
What sort of age was he when he got sick and came home? 25?
He must have been... now, wait a minute. He must have been about 30.
About 30.
Hmm.
And then he went to Canada, did he?
He stayed here for a while and thought he would farm the calf. And he was on the calf for a year or two. He was married when he was there, and Mother spent the first year of her married life, first 2 years, I think, on the calf.
Where did he get the calf from?
Well,
who did it belong to?
It belonged to Colonel Carey. Which it did for many years. I don't know how he came to possess it, but he did. He had a very nice house in Castletown. And poor man, George Carey, his son, died before him, and he had no daughters, and his wife had died earlier on, so he was... That, oh, he had very good friends in Castletown, no doubt, but I believe he was very lonely.
And did your father rent the calf before he got married or after he got
married? Before he got married.
Before he got married.
He was there. That was how he met Mother, really, going into Port Erin for things. Grandfather had the only shop there was in Port Erin.
Did he? The only shop.
And later they had the post office that was there. And Aunt Alice became an adept at reading the tape and also sending these messages, the dot and a dash, you know, the things.
The telegrams. Mm-hmm. Your mother's name was what?
Turnbull.
Turnbull.
Mm.
And this was the only shop in Port Erin.
It was the only shop.
Selling everything.
Yes. Well, there were all sorts of groceries, and they had a license too.
Did they?
And because after the buildings on the upper cliff were begun, the church and the various things, the Bellevue Hotel and various others. There was a man terribly ill with pneumonia, and an old retired doctor had gone in to see him, and he said to the son, get me some brandy. And he said, we haven't any, sir. Go down, go and get some brandy as quickly as you can. Your father's sinking for want of it, and I think we can pull him round. So he came and he arrived panting at the shop and told Uncle Edward what he wanted. And Uncle Edward said, but Tom, why didn't you go to that new shop up or even call in at the hotel? You would have got it there. I never thought of anybody to get it from but you, he said. He got the brandy and went back. And the man did survive. He never thought.
And when did your father and mother marry?
In 1877.
Yes. So your father then met your mother going in for provisions and yes. Married her and took her off to the calf.
Yes.
And were you the eldest child?
I was, well, of course I wasn't born on the calf, but I mean, we went back there as soon as mother was up, naturally. Mm. And
did you live?
And some of the work people that were a man and his wife who were called Hudgen, well, the man died before I remember him, though I must have seen him often, but old Mrs. Hudgen, we went to see her as long as she lived, and the daughter Ellen, who also had been on the calf, they lived down at Guernsey in a cottage there. Mrs. Hudgen always used to give us children biscuits, and she told us they grew on the rocks. There were no biscuits like them. They didn't, of course, but it was...
And what sort of numbers of people were there then? I mean, there's your father and mother and the children and who else?
Yes, they were there, and this man and wife. And the lighthouse keepers' wives at that time lived on the calf. And one of the Scotsmen married a Manx woman, so that when his time for retiring came, they came back to the Isle of Man. And they lived out at Portlaoise. We used to go and see them regularly. And because he taught Mother the Scottish way of making rag mats.
And did the Hudgens, did they use the Manx language or English, or did they speak Manx or English or...?
English.
English, no Manx.
But a great many of the older people did speak Manx in those days.
Mm. Do you speak Manx yourself, Miss Kidd? Or
no.
Did you?
No.
No.
I believe young John Crellin can, well, he's not so young now, but I always think of him as a kind of child. He can talk Manx, and he talks to Murray's little boy, I think. He did anyway, before the child went to school, and the child could reply to him. They were, they held a Manx conversation together.
So how long were you on the calf? I mean, what age were you when you left the calf? And why did you leave it?
Well, he left it because it wasn't, it was all right if, in a way for something to do, but he needed to earn more money, he thought, and he took it into his head that he'd go to Canada. and nothing would persuade him. Mother said nothing would persuade him not to go. So he went, and she was to follow. By that time, Alice was there too, and she was to follow in a year or two. Well, let me see now. I must have been about... perhaps I was four when he went to the to Canada. But in 2 years he came back ill. And in 2 more years he died.
Did he?
Mother was only married 10 years. Mm. I didn't realize that till long after I was grown up.
And where did your mother and you children live while he was in Canada?
Well, we lived half the year with grandfather at Port Dieron, and the other half the year we lived with Granny here.
At the Grove?
Mm-hmm. And then when Will was born, after he came home, there was no school in Port Dieron. And Granny said that if they send the two little girls to her, she would have a governess for us here, which she did. And I suppose I was 8 then. About 8.
So this was when, sort of 1886 or something like that, was it?
Yes, it would be. Father died in 1886. Must have been 1885 that we came, I think. Mm. Five, six, seven. Really, you see.
No. And then did your mother...
Well, then, of course... there was practically, there was very little money. Mother had to do her best to earn something to educate and bring up Will, you see, because Granny could take us, but she hadn't that much to spare.
No.
And of course, Auntie took on what she didn't know when Granny died, and Grandpapa had always been going to make a new will, but he never did. And his will was made when he was a rich man, not when he was had a moderate income. And so the money was all divided amongst the family. And it was all right as long as Granny lived, because she had the biggest portion. But what she had to be divided. So that Auntie really could hardly afford to take on this place.
No.
But, and you see, we weren't brought up to do anything. But I know she said if we would look after the garden and, Polly, the carriage horse was old, she was shot. And Auntie got a pony, and we looked after the pony and cart. We'd be all right here. But there was a man in the bank then. His son has retired over here now, Bobby Keg. He's in, what we call it?
Yes, indeed, I know him well.
And, his father was the banker in the Isle of Man Bank there, and he said to Auntie that if she'd allow him, he would call in some of the investments and put them to a better rate of interest, and it would be easier for her to carry on here. And which he did. He was very kind. Very.
Your grandmother was dead by this time, was she?
Yes.
And this is when, 1897, did you say?
Yes.
So you were all grown up, as you might say.
Yes,
you were all sort of young ladies.
Yes. And I remember so well, Auntie said, now you must promise you won't go away and do anything else or get married or anything, because you must look after the garden. And and the pony.
And the pony. And,
yes, well then, our friends, the Jacksons, had a pony, and the boys had all gone away to sea, and Ruby was looking after it, and so we felt quite competent to look after a pony. The poor pony, I think, suffered a bit from our ignorance, but still.
And by this time, of course, you had Thornhill next door to you with a family and friends there.
Yes.
And also Ormley Hall, yes?
Well, yes, because the people called Mannock lived at Ormley Hall for a time. We knew them very well. Mm. They really were very good to us.
When was Ormley Hall built and why? Mm? When was Ormley Hall built and why?
Oh, it must have been built now. Wait a minute. Oh. Became parson chaplain of Ramsey. His father came over and built it. Grandpapa was alive then. It must have been built about 1860, I should think.
Mm. And this is George Peyton's father built it.
Yes.
And he was a friend of your grandfather's, was he?
Yes. And I think their original home was in Skye. I'm not sure. I think it was.
And this
but
is...
you see, he had come here and was chaplain of... First of all, he was the first curate of St. Olive's, which was then chapel, not a parish, it was a chapel of East Lazare. Mm. And then he became chaplain of Ramsey, which was a chapel of East Mochrald. Mm. And he was there till he, I suppose he was there 30 years.
Yeah. And the father, and Ormley Hall, and your grandfather,
yes.
Well, great sort of whist.
Yes.
Whist
you see, two old Scotsmen. Mm-hmm.
round about then, this time, when your aunt
yes.
sort of had you to look after, just about the time Hall Caine was sort of at his peak.
Yes, yes. I remember him speaking from the balcony of the commissioner's place there. You know, it had a balcony, the building.
Go back to Hall Caine.
Yes. Hall Caine, you see, was member for Ramsey
yeah.
for a time. And on this occasion, he was addressing the voters from the balcony of the commissioner's building. And I had never heard him speak before, but he had a delightful voice, a very nice voice. Very clear and kind of musical. I know. And when you knew that he had run about the streets, no doubt it was as a treat, but barefoot. As a small boy sometimes, as you know. Mm.
And how did you girls react to his books?
Well, I enjoyed them all, but I don't think he brought out the best points always of the Manx character.
Well, my mother had the complete collection, of course.
Yes.
And as a small boy, I used to read them in part because in those days they were slightly naughty. And my mother always used to feel a mixture of sort of interest and abhorrence because, yeah, because she said she could put the names to the original people who were the characters.
Oh, yes.
Could you do that? I mean, could you say...
No, I couldn't. Except in very few cases. No, I don't think I could. I didn't know the people, the countryside people, in the way he did.
No.
And you know, she was so quick.
Because she always said that really Hall Caine was writing biography disguised as a novel.
Mm.
And that some of the things he said, that every Manx person knew exactly who he was talking about.
Yes. Well, of course, you see, they knew so many people all over the island, not only here in Ramsey,
yes,
but Castletown and
Shirley
and Malou and
yeah,
Russian,
yes,
and everywhere.
And Michael too.
And of course, wherever they went, they were always all so loved and appreciated.
Mm. Now, round about the same time, there was the Dumbles Bank failure.
Yes.
Did you have some money in that, or did your aunt have money in it? Or?
Yes.
And what happened?
Well, you know, the depositors, in the end, and if there hadn't been a kind of upset about it, there was plenty of money, really, in the various things to pay them. The depositors got, I don't know whether it was 18 shillings in the pound, they got very nearly all their money. It was the shareholders that suffered.
I see.
And if there hadn't been a panic, they needn't have suffered as much as they did.
Mm.
But a sort of bottom dropped out of the world, and farms and places were sold in a hurry to produce money, ready money, which if there had been a little more time, they'd have fetched more of their worth, and people wouldn't have been so hardly hit.
Did the other banks then gang up against Dumbles a bit, do you think?
Well, certainly the Isle of Man increased very much.
Mm.
But you see, I think Mr. Nelson said, oh, by the way, now I wonder what I did with that photograph of mine. I think he said that if Pars, that it would have paid them better to take over than to break the bank, which they did at the last minute. They found out something about the real thing that broke the bank was the buying of all those hotels that Mr. Bruce, I think he went off his head, poor man died, but poor Charlie Nelson had to bear the blame for the lot of them. And really, well, he had a failing. He at times took more than was good for them. And they used to get him away and make him drunk, and then he'd sign anything.
Mm.
They put the things in front of him and told him to sign, and he'd sign them. And of course, was it 7 years he was in jail? I think it was.
Was it?
But anyhow, He lived it down.
Where did he live?
In St. Olive's, that house just opposite St. Olive's church there.
Yeah.
And he added to it for the size of his family, for he had 10 children.
Blimey.
The eldest, Dan, was a little older than me, and I suppose Molly, the next one, she died young, was about my age. Nessie was Alistair's age. Berkeley, Cecil, Olive, Roger, Lucy, Hetty. The funniest thing, last year I had a letter from somewhere in Queensland from, she was no longer young. I was going to say from a girl, but she wasn't. She must have been about my own age, I should think, who wanted to know how many of the Nelson family were still in Ramsey. And she had come across a man named Quarry, who lived in the same township. And he told her to write to the Grove. He was in communication with some of his relations here, and he knew there was still some Gibbs living at the Grove, and that they would be able to tell her. So I had this letter, and I sat down and I answered it, and I said, "Well, I'm sorry to tell you that none of Charlie Nelson's children live here, but I'll give you an account of the lot of them and tell you where the survivors are." And I said, "The only one in England is the youngest girl, who's married to my cousin, Scott Reed, who's now Lord Reed, the head of the Lords of Appeal. And her nephew, Charles Nelson, who's in Rhodesia, Salisbury, I think. And he has a son and a daughter. Or at least he had a sister, I know. And he's got a son, and I don't know what else." So I sat down and wrote her a whole detailed account. And I hope she got it, but she never wrote and said thank you or anything else. And I nearly wrote again and asked, did she get it? Because I took a good deal of trouble about it and told her all the details I knew. Her father was Charles Nelson's brother, Berkeley. And his youngest brother, Eustace, who was a sailor and used to come here for his shore leave at times, he also settled in Australia, but I don't know where. And this one was, I think, Edward. And John was in America, because Mr. Nelson went to see him before John was the eldest of them all. And they were all sons of the rector of Bride, and used to walk into the grammar school every day, and Mr. Nelson could never understand why people were so afraid of walking, he said. "We walked into the grammar school every day."
From Bride? And back?
Yes. And they, I suppose, carried sandwiches or something in their pockets because they'd get home.
And what's the grammar school in those days in Waterloo Road?
It was in Waterloo Road, yes, in the old grammar school, the building.
Where the
but at one time they talked of pulling down. I hope they don't, because it's one of the few nice buildings in Ramsey.
Where the youth centre is.
Yes.
Amazing.
And the Mysore cottages. I hope they don't pull them down to modernise them.
And they were Sir Mark Cubbon, weren't they?
Yes. And there is room enough at the back to build a little extra. I know the first one, Miss... what was her name? Oh, dear. Well, anyhow, she added a little bit to the back of hers and put a bath in it. But there is an alcove place where you could put a bath without building an addition. But it always amused us because she did this off her own bet. And then she sent the bill to Mark Harrison. Mark paid it.
Yes, yes. Yes, yes, yes. Well, what about...
He was the lawyer to the company.
Nelson was?
Yes.
And who was the boss man?
And you see, when they did these big deals with the tellers and that kind of thing, He was there, but unfortunately, in those days, if you gave him too much to drink, he didn't know what he was doing. I mean, he'd sign anything if you put and said, "Here, now, sign this," he'd sign it.
And who was the sort of chairman of the bank or the managing director?
A man named Bruce, Alexander Bruce. And he came from some part of Scotland, I'm not quite sure. Got photographs of him and Mrs. Bruce and the children. For the old Bank of Mona, I think, which was an offshoot from some bank in Glasgow. At least I think that. But anyhow, the Bank of Mona collapsed, and he was, of course, without a job.
Bruce?
Bruce, yes. And they were Scots folk, and Granny had them staying here for a time, he and Mrs. Bruce, and two girls. And then Mr. Collister and various others got the Isle of Man bank going, and he was put in as the manager, the head in Douglas.
Of the Isle of Man Bank or of Dumble's Bank?
Of the Isle of Man Bank.
The Isle of Man Bank.
Mm. There was no doubt that he was a clever man, but he just, I don't know what took him, but he just overreached himself in a kind of way, because he had what really broke the bank was that he gave fantastic sums to the Bellevue Hotel and the, what was the other one, in Port Erin, and another hotel somewhere else. And they didn't, they weren't worth it. And then Pars were on the lookout of something, I suppose, to enlarge their banking thing. I suppose, I don't know whether they were a bank in London or whether it was in the north. But anyhow, Pars came over to take over Dumble's Bank. It wasn't the Isle of Man Bank he got going in, it was Dumble's Bank.
Yeah, Dumble's Bank, yes, not the Isle of Man Bank, yeah.
And Mr. He bought these hotels, and then, of course, you see, he fell ill. I think he had a stroke. I'm not sure, but he died anyway. And General Stevenson was old and infirm. He was another of the directors. And Mr.